Hey, good evening. Let's see if we can get this started. All right, thank you very much. Good evening. I'm Mark Woodruff. I'm the CEO of City in Australia. It's my great pleasure to host you tonight for the welcome dinner at the A50 Economic Forum. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land, and pay my respects to the elders both past and present. I want to thank those who have joined us to attend this event from overseas. It's a privilege to be joined by global investors representing the US, Canada, Europe, Japan, Malaysia, the Middle East, and Singapore. Thank you to all the local business leaders who have also joined us tonight. A couple of special acknowledgements. Firstly, to the Treasurer, the Honourable Dr. Jim Chalmers, and the Australian Consul General in New York, Heather Ridout, who have joined us this evening. I'd also like to pay particular thanks to their teams who have really helped tremendously in bringing this forum together. So Jim and Heather, thank you. Tonight we will hear from the Deputy Governor of Reserve Bank of Australia, Andrew Houser. Andrew was appointed Deputy Governor in February this year. He is the Deputy Chair of the Reserve Bank Board. He joined the RBA following a 30-year career with the Bank of England, most recently as Executive Director for Markets. He has also held senior roles across most of the Bank of England's major functions, including leading its inflation report, its international economic analysis, and its regional agency's intelligence gathering. There will be time for Q&A after Andrew's speech, and I'd also like to highlight that we've been joined by some members of the media. But Andrew, ahead of your inaugural speech, I'd like to formally congratulate you on your appointment, and in particular, welcome you and your family to Australia. So please join me in welcoming Andrew to the stage. Thank you. This was designed for me, not Andrew.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Right, well, thank you very much, and thank you for that welcome. Picture, if you can, a thriving trading hub on the Australian coast. It uses imported capital equipment and processes and temporary migrant labour to extract and process an abundant natural resource for on sale to China. The business brings wealth and prosperity to the local community. Over time, public debate emerges about where the rewards are being fairly divided between locals and foreigners and how to manage ecological degradation. A mine or refinery, perhaps, in present-day Western Australia or Queensland? Could be. But what I've actually described are the arrangements for trading in trepang, or sea cucumbers, a Chinese delicacy that began around 1700 between the Yolngu people of Arnhem Land and itinerant fishermen from Makassar on Sulawesi, part of modern-day Indonesia. By the mid-19th century, the Makassar fleet was supplying an amazing 900 tonnes of trepang to China every year. Now, the existence of such a striking historical echo of today's debates is less surprising when one remembers that Australia is home to the oldest continuing culture on Earth. For more than 65,000 years, this continent has been cultivated by First Nations people. And so, like you, Mark, I want to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation as the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which we're meeting this evening, and pay my respects to elders past and present. I also want to welcome you to the A50 Forum, an event initiated in 2016 to highlight the benefits of investing in Australia. And there are many important issues to discuss in the current climate. The organisers, Mark and others, have put together a fantastic programme tomorrow involving government leaders, the regulatory community, and the corporate and financial sectors to do just that. And with such a rich main course to come, I've no intention of competing. Instead, I'm going to offer merely a light starter to put tomorrow's discussions in context, reviewing the historical sources of economic growth in Australia and the role played by foreign investment. Now, when economic conditions are as challenging as they are today, it can be easy to forget just how prosperous modern Australia actually is. Measures of relative affluence, such as GDP per head, or wealth per head, regularly place the country in the top echelon globally. Of course, the distribution of that prosperity is not uniform. So it would be brave for a new and infatuated stranger, that's me, to declare Australia an earthly paradise. But coming as I do from a country whose GDP per head has been more or less static since the global financial crisis and lies between one quarter and one third lower than Australia's, I can tell you that cross-country gap feels very real. How Australia got here is long debated, but this evening I wanted to discuss three important drivers: its unusually diverse range of resource endowments below ground, above ground, and beyond the sea; its strong but adaptable pro-growth institutions supporting political, legal, macro, microeconomic, and financial stability; and its long-standing welcoming environment for foreign investment. Now, many countries have resource endowments of some kind, but what seems amazing to me about Australia is it seems to have pretty much the full set. That diversity can be seen in the sort of swirling colours in this chart, which shows the evolving shape of Australian exports over the past two centuries. But it also applies to as yet untapped potential. And to see that more clearly, let's divide Australia's endowments into three. Below ground. Now, it's sometimes said that Australia has long relied on old world mining exports, and while it's true that more than half of today's goods exports consist of iron ore, gas and coal, the purple, black and red on this chart, that's not a long-standing feature of the economy. The only significant mining export of the 19th century was gold, pictured in gold on the chart. And for much of the 20th century, mining played little part in Australia's trade. More importantly for the future, Australia has large shares of global reserves of many of the minerals critical to new world technologies and energy transition industries, shown here perhaps suitably in what I thought was going to look like teal, but doesn't quite on the slide. With significant headroom to expand current production, the gap between the dots and the bars, given the right investment and right demand conditions. Above ground, for over 150 years, agriculture, particularly wool, obviously dominated Australia's exports. And while that dominance has now pivoted to mining, other above-ground resources have grown significantly. In particular, Australia's human capital ranks highly globally, bucking the trend of countries with significant commodity dependencies, as shown here, and positioning the country well to take advantage of developments in services and technology, as well as natural resources. Indeed, nearly one-fifth of Australia's total exports consists of services, principally inbound tourism and education. But one of Australia's most significant above-ground resource endowments has no physical form at all, and that's sunlight. Multiplying the intensity of the Australian sun using the World Bank's global horizontal irradiation metric, it does exist, by its enormous landmass, Australia has the largest assessed theoretical potential solar capacity in the world. Now, I should say the RBA likes to check its data very carefully, and they pointed out to me that actually this measure doesn't go above a certain latitude upwards and downwards, and that it's possible that Russia has a larger solar capacity. I'm not sure. We had a lively debate about how Siberia could count on that, but nonetheless, there is a footnote in the paper to say that it is possible that Australia isn't number one. I think that's unlikely. I think that's safe, and I won't make a cricket joke. Estimates of realizable capacity, after allowing for the many practical constraints of real-world power generation, lie well below that theoretical maximum. But they still suggest there's very substantial further headroom available compared to today's headroom output. Beyond the sea, Australia's geographical position, lying as it does a long way from some of its closest partners, is sometimes said to confer an economic disadvantage, the tyranny of distance. But as Ian MacLean pointed out, this is too simplistic. During the 19th and a good part of the 20th century, a combination of comparative advantage, rapidly improving transport technologies, and colonial preference meant that economic growth was supported by advantageous trading arrangements with the United Kingdom, despite it being as far away as it's possible to get. In recent decades, the focus of trade relations has obviously pivoted decisively towards Asia, but Australia has also maintained a broader and deeper network of political and economic relationships within and beyond the Asia-Pacific region, with which to navigate these shifting tides of economic opportunity. Strong resources alone, though, are rarely sufficient to guarantee prosperity. Indeed, the reverse is more often true, a phenomenon often termed the resource curse. Donald Horne's 1964 polemic, The Lucky Country, predicted Australia would eventually be cursed too, but 60 years on from that book's first publication, real GDP per head has more than tripled, and that isn't just luck. Endowments bring opportunity, but harnessing them for a country's greater good takes something more, and Australia's real secret sauce has been its strong but adaptable pro-growth institutions. Among Australia's greatest assets has been its political institutions, its legal system, and its civil service. Australians do seem to debate the merits of its political arrangements from time to time, but the country regularly scores in the top deciles of objective global measures of liberal democracy. And through history, Australia has regularly had to make tough national economic decisions on the squatters' rights in the 19th century, on the appropriate balance between agriculture, extraction, and manufacturing in the mid-20th century, or on the pace of deregulation in the 80s, 1980s, and 1990s. In each case, the debate may have been noisy, drawn out, and non-linear, but assisted by Australia's top-flight legal and civil service, the outcomes have more often been right than wrong. Australia's macroeconomic framework has been a clear strength over the past 40 years as well. Resource-rich countries can suffer significant economic volatility when the prices for their key outputs adjust. Australia's certainly had its fair share of that over its longer history. But today, there are powerful shock absorbers in place to reduce that buffering. First, unlike most commodity exporters, Australia has a fully flexible exchange rate. Second, the RBA has independent authority for setting monetary policy to achieve a flexible inflation target that gives appropriate weight to employment outcomes, similar to that in the US. And third, gross public debt, shown here in blue, lies well below that of many other developed countries, including, it has to be said, my own country of origin. On the microeconomic side, the reforms of recent decades have left Australia with internationally open and transparent product markets, low tariffs, and relatively open capital account. And financial stability is overseen by a comprehensive set of regulators. The major banks are liquid and strongly capitalized. There's a well-developed capital markets infrastructure, and domestic non-banks are increasingly interested in coming in alongside overseas investors in onshore projects as part of joint ventures. Now, when Walter Wriston, who's Citibank's CEO from 1967 to 1984, I had to double check those dates. I'm not sure quite the longevity of the average CEO these days, but said that capital goes where it's welcome and it stays where it's well treated. He could have been describing Australia. And that matters because other than a very brief period around the turn of the 20th century and another around the Second World War, Australia has run persistent current account deficits, and just to spell that out, it means that they've drawn on overseas funding to help fund onshore investment for most of the past 160 years, and this looks a bit like scribble here, but if you look at the lower panel of that chart, it means the blue line lies below the zero line. Now, in the early days, that financing sometimes came from rather unconventional sources. And just north of where we're sitting tonight, you can see it through there, this row of warehouses here, lies a cove originally known as Melia Wool, but later renamed after Robert Campbell, who was a businessman. Now, Campbell built those warehouses that you can still see there to hold the wares of 19th century trade, sugar, wool, whale oil, seal skins, and I'm told Peruvian guano. He also ran the Sydney branch of the New South Wales Savings Bank, known colloquially as Campbell's Bank after him. Newly arrived convicts were first encouraged and then from 1822 forced to deposit any assets they brought with them in the savings bank until their condition was improved by their good behaviour. Now, many of those deposits were obviously pitifully small, but some amounted to real money. In fact, one Thomas Bolton deposited £42, 18 shillings and fourpence, which may not mean much to most people, but it was roughly, at that time, the annual salary of a well-to-do London builder. This money was used to fund local development. And a savings bank document from 1824 shows a 100-acre parcel of land near present-day Petersham in Sydney passing hands for £100. Today, 200 years on, I should take a bet on this, that land will be worth at least $2 billion, a striking illustration of the scale of change in the Australian economy over that period. Now, persistent current account deficits like these can drive a sense of national angst that you're living beyond your means, risking a sudden drying up of credit or an unaffordable rise in funding costs. And Australia found itself in a particularly challenging situation of that kind between the world wars, when a combination of weak growth, overborrowing in sterling, and the British determination to stick to the gold standard caused the public debt burden to balloon dangerously. In August 1930, Sir Otto Niemeyer, a Bank of England official, I'm afraid to say, delivered a pretty obnoxious speech to the Melbourne Conference of Commonwealth and State Leaders, in which he warned Australia that cold facts must be faced and that it had 2 years to get its house in order before key debt tranches matured. His private diaries don't bear close reading either, I can tell you, but I'm not going to read those out. His intervention was so profound, it caused a split in the Australian Labor Party. Over the decades that followed, however, governments around the world came increasingly to the view that persistent overseas borrowing could in fact be sustained, so long as it reflected the funding of profitable onshore investment or so-called consumption smoothing, for example, by young households expecting their lifetime income to rise. And that view, dubbed the Pitchford thesis in Australia in the 80s, shaped a raft of policy reforms, including floating the exchange rate, reducing or eliminating a wide range of capital controls, and external financing switched increasingly from public to private sector. Now, questions about external sustainability can clearly still arise, even in the modern era. After the 2016 Brexit referendum, for example, the then Bank of England Governor Mark Carney described the UK's current account deficit as relying on what he called the kindness of strangers, Blanche Dubois' memorable last line in A Streetcar Named Desire. Australia's experience in recent decades has been much more positive than that, though, for at least three reasons. First, Australia has generated substantial onshore investment opportunities, particularly during the mining boom of the noughties, but since then as well. Second, borrowing has been structured in ways that make it relatively resilient to shocks, being denominated predominantly or hedged back to local currency, reducing exposure to exchange rate adjustments, and issued at increasingly longer maturities, reducing rollover risk. But third, Australia has also been through an unusual period since 2019 of running current account surpluses, exporting rather than importing capital in net terms, helping to halve the country's net overseas liabilities, shown here in red. Now, those surpluses reflect all sorts of causes. Part of it was a classic excess of national saving over investment, savings boosted by the sharp rise in terms of trade, the structural increase in super fund balances, and precautionary accumulation during COVID. Investment growth also normalised somewhat after the mining boom. Australia's net investment income rose for a period as a result of changes in relative asset prices, and capital flows were affected by mergers and acquisitions. Now, given all that, it's not clear whether the surplus will persist. The most recent data suggests it might not. But even if it doesn't, that doesn't mean Australia's need for inward foreign investment is a thing of the past. And that's because, as this chart shows, substantial amounts of national savings are placed in overseas assets. To diversify risk and return, the super funds alone hold nearly half of their portfolio offshore. With a substantial pipeline of investment projects waiting to be financed, that leaves many opportunities for inward investment. And consistent with that, public and private Australian debt remains in strong demand right around the world. And Australia remains one of the top recipients of inward foreign direct investment globally when expressed as a share of GDP. So let me conclude. No one has yet identified a single golden source of national prosperity, but Australia has come pretty close. Three key things have helped it navigate those massive changes in global economic and financial system, generating wealth for its people and ensuring it remains an attractive location for investment in equal measure. Its unusually diverse range of resource endowments, below ground, both old world and new, above ground in human capital, agriculture and solar capacity, and beyond the seas in its geographical position. Its strong but adaptable pro-growth institutions, political, legal, macro, microeconomic and financial stability, and its long-standing welcoming environment for foreign investment. Those things aren't enough to guarantee prosperity. In a small open economy, Australia relies on the continued functioning of global institutions too, and it relies on making the right policy calls. And tomorrow's sessions are all about how to do that in the current climate. So, Mark, I wish you well in those discussions. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Andrew. I think that set a fantastic foundation for tomorrow. But let me ask the first question and we'll throw to the audience. You've been here for 5 months. I know you've done like a trip out west. You've spoken to a lot of business leaders here. What's from perception to reality? What's been the most surprising factor for you since you've been here?
You're right. I've been to Melbourne. I've been to Perth. I've been to Townsville as well, which was a real eye opener up in the, what I was told to call FNQ. Although I'm not sure if FNQ is an okay phrase or not. So if I've just been very rude, I guess I'm on the next boat back, particularly with
Jim from Queensland.
He can have. what's the biggest surprise? Not sure quite how to answer that. I would say this. I have a great Bank of England's principle used to be human and humble, and I think it is quite important to come across and be humble about how much there is to learn. Coming to a new society, you might not know, one of the risks for a Brit coming to Australia is you think, oh, this is pretty much like home. Everything seems much the same. And if you're going to Tokyo, if you're going to Singapore, if you're going to New Delhi, you'd never have that view because language would be changed, everything would be changed. And it's an incredibly important thing to guard against, I think, because it's a pretty classic British attitude, I suppose. You know, and I already know how this place works. And B, it also closes your horizons to learning about what's new. And one of the reasons I went to Queensland and Perth first is that obviously both of those places in different ways are kind of engines of growth of Australia and in ways that are very, very different to the UK. So I mean, meeting with mining companies in Perth, meeting with some of those who are working on the pipeline, enormous pipeline, staggering pipeline, actually, of public and private projects up in the northeast. We went to a company, which I think RBA rules prevent me from describing so that you could actually just detect it, but it was a metal refinery that ran largely off solar power. Pretty eye-opening, actually, to a sort of green 54-year-old Brit coming from a largely service-based economy and hearing how those places are going. So that's probably a rather dry and boring answer to your question. I'm sure there are more fun things I could also say about my life in Sydney and so forth, but it's enormously motivating, actually, to come, I won't say late in my career, but later in my career and really get your hands around a very new and challenging set of issues. There's work to do at the RBA as well, obviously, in terms of modernising and bringing the RBA up to speed, but I've been absolutely hugely bowled away by the ability and quality of the people there. So that's all, no downside. Final point, when I end, I'm trying to play for time so you don't ask me about inflation.
it may not be me.
Let me tell you a story. Let me take you right back. bloody well, I've forgotten what I was going to say.
We'll go to the questions then.
I will tell you. So I go to a lot of meetings with very senior people, and I have these very high discussions about strategy and very, very informative and everything. At the end, they often lean over to me and say, I've got to ask you, mate, why did you come here? And I always reply to them, why would you not, actually? What is there not to like about the challenge that's coming here? And some of it's very difficult, some difficult challenges at the moment. But anyway, perhaps I'm sounding a bit like I've swallowed the happy gas, but there's not much not to not like here.
That's very true. And sometimes we undersell ourselves.
Well, I think that's right.
In this country.
Yeah. I was surprised. I thought Australians were instinctively optimistic, but I'm told it's the reverse. But anyway.
Let's go to questions from the floor. I'll take a couple from the floor and then we'll go to the media if they've got some. Actually, over the back, I think. Thank you.
Deputy Governor, thank you very much for the speech tonight on your overview on Australia. I also wanted to thank you for the opportunity to ask a question, but I am going to ask a question on the more recent information that we have on the economy. Given that RBA has categorised the economy as being steered down the narrow path, but that path is potentially getting a little narrower, I wanted to ask your thoughts around, obviously, services inflation has been something that has been important in assessing whether or not the economy is still on the narrow path. Could I ask your thoughts, given we got an update yesterday on more persistent services inflation, how that may play into your thoughts on the outlook?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right in what you say. I think the challenge of persistent services inflation is not unique, and you know this, to Australia. Actually, what is interesting, if you draw the chart of inflation and then you break it down into services and goods, and obviously goods have to a large extent come off, and in a number of countries are actually in deflation, not in Australia. The picture's look incredibly similar. And I think there's probably something there that all of us need, you know, central banks to probably learn and understand about a little bit more. Look, the number yesterday obviously picked up a bit, and there was quite a substantial market reaction. You didn't say where you worked, but I'm guessing it's in the financial sector somewhere.
I work in a balance sheet.
Obviously picked up a little bit, but I think look, if you look at our statement from last month, we said three things, right? Inflation remains above target and is proving persistent. The outlook remains highly uncertain, and returning to inflation, you know, to target is the priority. And all three of those things were true a month ago, you know, and they're true now. I think on your question about how well do we understand services inflation, and again, I would generalize from the RBA alone to elsewhere, obviously market services inflation did fall a little bit in the most recent data. It was actually welcome, and if anything, there's an interesting sort of, I wouldn't say mini puzzle in the data as to why it was services that was somewhat weaker, and maybe goods, and particularly durable goods, were a little bit stronger. But look, there are a number of different hypotheses about what's going on here. Some of them have different, and they have different implications for policy. One possibility is just that it's taking a little bit longer for policy to feed through to service inflation than goods. The right policy response to that clearly would be to hold your nerve. We're coming down in a slightly bumpy way, but we are coming down. And if you look backwards, that is, in fact, exactly what's been happening. Whether it continues to be the case, we can debate. It could be telling you something important about the labour market, because service prices are obviously often a function of the cost of labour in general. And obviously, what has been extraordinary, I think, about the experience of the labour market, not just in Australia, but globally as well, is just how strongly it has performed. The number of jobs that have been created is an enormous, and you know, actually, I think sometimes you talk about sort of not celebrating success enough. This is an incredible achievement when you think about adjustments of this scale in the past. They have almost always involved very, very sharp adjustment in the labour market. So far, we haven't done that, and that's obviously been part of our strategy, but it could be part of why services inflation is taking a little bit longer to come down. Of course, the other point is that services prices sometimes consist of administrative prices, which monetary policy, frankly, quite hard to get at. Now, there's an interesting question there. Do you strip them out and just, you know, control the things you can't control, or do you have to push the rest of the, you know, inflation basket down a little bit further in order to bring inflation back to target? That's a challenge and a question for central banks. So I think, look, you've put your finger on a very important question, one that we all need to understand better, and it's an important part of our job to do that.
Thank you. One more from the floor, if we've got one. Just over the back here.
Yeah. Thanks, Andrew. Matt Sherwood, Perpetual Investments. I was just thinking, do you think monetary policy is really the ideal tool to be dealing with this inflation crisis, because, or inflation issue, I should say, it's not a crisis, because the issues of the global economy to me look like they're coming from deficient aggregate supply, given the breakdown of supply chains, deglobalisation, localisation as such. And, you know, I would argue that monetary policy is not necessarily the tool to be dealing with that. Because I do note that we don't know a lot about this inflation cycle. It's very different to what we've seen before. Bank of Canada cuts rates, everything's looking good, then all of a sudden inflation spikes up. Europe's economy recovers, and now the PMI is dropping sharply below 50. So it seems the very uneven cycle? And as such, do we need more simple analysis rather than using econometric models from the last cycle to actually just be looking at services inflation, unemployment, wages growth, et cetera, and come to more simple conclusions? So it's a whole bunch of questions.
I know. How many questions are you going to ask me?
You only have to answer one.
I know. That's right. That's a trick that I haven't yet learned. I'll try and take as many of them as I can. I grew up working with Mervyn King, who was obviously one of the governors of the Bank of England. He was a full adherent to the concept that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And you don't get inflation in non-monetary economies. So I think we should start from the point that actually there's nobody other than the central bank, ultimately, that can anchor inflation in the long run. So to your point, should we give up on monetary policy and try something else? I mean, no, because that will end in failure. However, to your point about are we being moved around by movements in the supply side that are different, challenging, and potentially much bigger in the past, I think you put your finger on something terrifically, you know, important. We've obviously been through a very major set of supply shocks as part of COVID, and the UK in terms of Brexit, and, you know, could go on. It probably is fair to say that central banks, you know, need the mark on their exam paper for that period, which, you know, needs some improvement in terms of understanding some of those shocks, albeit they happen very rapidly. If you look forward, you might think about geopolitics, you might think about the change and its implications for the changing nature of global trading channels. You might think about, obviously, the energy transition as well, are all going to have potentially very major effects on the supply side. However, and this is where I think I come back to my don't give up on monetary policy thing yet, you know, the challenge, the goal of monetary policy is to bring demand, nominal demand, into line with where the supply capacity of the economy is at any particular moment. Now, if that target is moving around more than you thought it was in the past, if it's being moved by different shocks, you really do need to understand those shocks better than you did in the past. And if you were to look at, you know, the headcount in central banks, you were to say, how many of you very loosely are allocated to understand the demand side of the economy, and how many of you are allocated to the demand supply side of the economy? It's, you know, it's 90-10 or 95-5 or whatever it might be, and that may need to change in the future. But that's a point about the analysis of central banks. It's not about their toolkit. Their toolkit will, I would argue, always remain control of the supply and price of money, and that would be true in a Bitcoin economy just as much as it would be in a fiat economy. What we need to do is understand the supply side better. And all your points about better models and all the rest of it are right, but that's a joint challenge.
Thank you. We've got time for...
a whole of the back row. In time.
We can take one more. I think we've got one more from the floor and then one from the media. Junbei.
Thank you. Just a quick question. So you mentioned all of the influences. How much of your the financial markets play into that decision-making process, you know, with the volatility in the financial markets, tightening of financial condition? So how do you see that?
I think it's a great question, and not one, again, that central banks have historically always done very well at. I spent many years at the Bank of England running markets function, and during periods in which, you know, it was impossible to ignore, right? So the global financial crisis obviously had fundamental implications for the economic outlook. The LDI crisis that we went through in 22, you know, ditto. Had we not had built up sufficient understanding of how the financial system worked and how that transmission mechanism fed into the economic system, I think we would have been in a difficult place. I mean, it's not quite men are from Mars and women are from Venus, but obviously the people that work on the economics side and the financial side are often different people with different mindsets and different ways of thinking, and that's a good thing. Because that leads to the sort of challenge internally that, you know, can be quite hard to generate in some public organizations. So I think, you know, thinking about how do you measure the stance of monetary policy, for example, we always historically used to just use the short interest rate. You know, then we learned that you needed to use the yield curve as well. Now we know that we need to think about a whole range of financial market prices at the price off the yield curve, and becoming increasingly important. I was sitting next to someone, let's just say, in the private finance sector, and certainly in the UK, if not in Australia yet, understanding how those flows a variant, which is a very big challenge in terms of data and in terms of how those things work, is really, really important. Could it mean that we make as big a policy mistake as, say, if we mismodeled the supply side? I don't know. But these are all part of a much bigger agenda, I think, for central banks thinking about where next. You're going to ask another question.
So if the share price falls 10% of the, Australian equities falls 10% with your, potential increase in interest rate, does that play in your thinking?
That's definitely a sting in the tail. It might do. Everything counts. Everything counts.
Am I stretching the friendship if we take two from the back of the room?
No, go on.
Okay.
They came mere feet from wherever they came from.
Thank you for taking the question, Andrew. This is Swati from Bloomberg News. My question is, RBA is known as a reluctant rate hiker in the economist analyst circles and in the press as well. And from what I understand when you answered the inflation question is also that the right policy response is to hold your nerve. Is that a correct categorization of...
Swati didn't get where she is today by accurately quoting public officials. That's not what I said. I said there are a wide variety of different ways of thinking about services prices, all of which would have different implications for the policy stance. I think, look, there's a lot for us to reflect on ahead of the meeting in August. What is important, I think, is we don't. And I'm interested that the market reacts to one number. I mean, that's fine. But there's a whole series of data coming out between now and when we meet in August. There are two measures of retail sales, which have been on the floor. I'd like to remind you, there's an important release on employment. There's the Q2 inflation number, bearing in mind that the numbers that we spent a bit of time earlier talking about are only partial, right? And that's something I'm not used to from the UK, that the monthly indicators don't contain a full sample of prices. There's business surveys and you name it. It would be a bad mistake to set policy on the basis of one number, and we don't intend to do that.
Okay, the last one.
Peter Hannam from The Guardian. Just wonder if you could reflect on your experience coming from a central bank with a specialised monetary policy board, and obviously we don't have that in Australia yet, but might do soon. From your experience dealing with, say, non-specialists, would you say that there's a greater attention paid maybe to the hardship of the wider audience than a more specialised monetary policy group might have? And does that... likely suggest perhaps that holding the nerve longer than would be the case in a specialised board like the UK?
I mean, that sounds like a very interesting academic topic, actually, for analysis. I wouldn't know necessarily how to begin answering it. I'll make a couple of points. I've been very impressed by the debate on the board so far. You'd probably expect me to say that, but it's true. You have people on that board with a very wide range of backgrounds who do bring a diversity of perspective, as you say, not just of people that are struggling, but also business conditions and from right around the country as well. Those things are valuable and important. We also have a liaison function, as you know, the RBA, which where I was in Townsville and Perth and Melbourne, I was visiting firms with them. So we have a wide variety of ways of getting, non-technical, spreadsheety, DSG model kind of information in to complement the pointy-headed stuff, if that is your point. I don't really see any reason why people's background should give them a bias one way or the other, but obviously the point of ensuring that you don't get those biases is to have collective decision-making and to have groups challenging each other. And although I didn't used to believe this, that decisions are better made by committee than by individuals, it turns out to be overwhelmingly true as an academic matter that if you do a bunch of controlled experiments on monetary policy, you either have people deciding on their own or you have people as a group deciding, you get better outcomes in general from the groups. And you always have people at the extremes, and the groups bring the decision back to the kind of central case. So how do I know? But I'd be very, very surprised if the different structures give a bias. What I would say is that the quality of debate on the board is different from the nature of the debate in the UK, but no less bad for that, and in some ways probably more insightful. You wouldn't believe, some of your economists in the room, how petty debates between professional economists can get. Sometimes when you desperately want them to make a decision about interest rates, I say that as someone who until recently was on the other side of the table, we're blessedly relieved from that.
Well, it's a great way to finish. So,
let's go with that.
Thank you, Andrew. I think, as I said before, you set a great foundation for tomorrow. But I think one of the things in your speech was about the transparency and the sophistication of policymaking here in Australia over a long period of time. And one of the key foundations of that is your willingness to give time in forums like this to us and to provide that transparency. So thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Andrew.
Thank you.